Hello, Jeroen.
Hello, Dylan.
And what are we talking about today?
Today, we're going to talk about learning.
Ooh, yeah. I love this topic.
So we recently talked with Richard Feldman about learning Elm, or teaching Elm, actually. And now we're going to talk about learning.
The other side, yes. So, all right, Jeroen, I've got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
How did you learn to make impossible states impossible? Do you recall that experience? I'm guessing it was earlier in your Elm career.
Yeah, definitely earlier. First of all, it was Richard Feldman who taught me that in his talk.
Yes, introduced the concept, gave it a name, which is very powerful. Coining a term is very powerful for learning.
But I did not know it before, that's for sure.
I didn't. It wasn't on my radar either before that talk.
So it was not even something I was trying to do. But I was not even doing Elm at the time. So when was the talk again? 2017?
2016.
2016. Okay. So 2016. So I did not watch it in 2016, I think. I watched it later on. But how did I learn it? I guess I was just trying to reenact whatever Richard was saying in his talk and thinking about it and then putting it into practice in some of my projects, like thinking about what can go wrong in some particular model and then trying to make that impossible. I'm not sure what more I can tell you.
Yeah, I think, that's pretty similar to my experience. So I think conference talks are such a powerful learning tool, but similar to your experience you just shared and my experience, I think that conference talks are only as useful as you're applying them to your own context. So that's part of the equation. So like, I remember when I was learning Elm, I think I started learning Elm around 2017. So there are a lot of great conference talks out. And
mm-hmm.
I think I started learning Elm like around when the ElmConf 2017 talks started coming out. So I had this fresh batch of new great talks coming out. But I went back and watched all these talks. And I was building like my first real, you know, Beyond Hello World Elm project. I actually chose to create a project in order to become better at Elm. And the project was Mobster, which is this like pair mob programming timer tool that I built. It's an Electron application. And I built it because I wanted like a fun side project that I could use to explore some Elm techniques. So the first thing I went and did when I learned about make impossible states impossible was, ooh, what can I do to my mobster code base to apply this? And so I think that that's such an important part of the learning process is to have a playground to go apply some ideas. You can read all the books you want. You can, you know, watch an online course. You can watch a conference talk. Those things are very important. And without those things, you wouldn't know the concept of make impossible states impossible. And you wouldn't have all these great ideas about the steps of test-driven development and things like that. You know, perhaps you learned some things from a podcast, hopefully. But, you know, that's an important step. But then you have to, you know, you have to put the fuel in the tank, but then you have to drive the car and you have to apply the learning somehow.
I know that a lot of people, when they try to learn like a new language, they redo projects that they know or that they have written before, but in the new language. So you're familiar with JavaScript, you want to learn Elm, do the same project in Elm. So you won't get stuck by the same issues. You don't have to restyle everything. You don't have to think about database interaction. So you don't have to deal with all the problems that are not language specific.
Right.
So the only thing that is different is the language. So whatever you will learn is language specific.
Yes, you can like learn on one dimension because the dimension of solving that particular type of problem and getting data from some backend and that all those types of things you've done before and you're familiar with. Yeah, I've used that technique a lot actually. I really like creating focused exercises to apply learning. I think, mm-hmm. you know, these are two different interesting contexts for learning, which I think are both important. There's the small scale exercise and the real world project. And I think they both play a role. I think that small scale exercises are very good for developing a skill. So one of the most important things about learning is the feedback loop. So, you know, what does that mean for learning? It means that you have a way to tell, is the technique you're working, is the technique you're applying effective? Do you like it? Do you like how it looks? Is it solving the problem you expected it to? Is it breaking your code? Is it introducing a bug? If you don't know those things, you're not really learning. If you just start trying to do make impossible states impossible, and you're applying it in a context where you don't really know if it's solving the problem you think it's solving, you're not very familiar with the types, it's a little bit over your head, the you know, area you're experimenting with, you're not really learning. But so you need that feedback loop. You need to, and having very small scale exercises and problems can be good for getting that very tight feedback loop. So I think like creating a focused exercise for learning the specific thing you're trying to do, you know, might be like, I'm going to make a to-do list application. I'm going to create this a storefront with the UI, and I'm going to try that with Elm UI and with Elm CSS.
I remember that Richard in his Elm in Action book. So from start to finish of the book, you write an Elm application, but you do so in chunks. So you do a pretty short exercise in each chapter. So same idea, I think.
Right. Yeah, having a focused exercise with a clear goal is so useful. And I mean, as we talk about often, also breaking it down into tiny steps and tiny commits, that's another thing that increases the feedback loop. You know, if you're taking big steps, changing a lot of things at once, then it's hard to evaluate the technique you're applying.
Yeah, like what have I just done?
Yeah.
I did too many things.
And if you're trying to learn make impossible states impossible, that philosophy, and then you are also fixing a bug somewhere and changing something in the UI, and like you're diluting that learning. So doing too many things at once, doing too big of steps, all these things that lengthen the feedback loop, they're diluting learning. So I think that's a really core point, that just keep in mind when you're learning, are you giving yourself a nice feedback loop? One of my favorite things to do when I'm learning a new technique or a new language is to do a test-driven development exercise, you know?
What kind of thing do you then do?
You know, the bowling kata where you're doing bowling, or like tennis kata where you're doing a tennis scoring system, or Roman numerals kata. Katas that, you know, I've done hundreds of times, but applying it, you know, as you were saying earlier, with applying a familiar problem with a new concept or technique. So that's one of my favorite techniques. If I'm just pull out a test room and development exercise, and that is one of the best feedback loops you can imagine, because you have a very simple exercise. You can experiment. You have tests to tell you if your experiment is safe or not.
You also learn how to write tests in that language.
You also learn how to write tests, which is very important as well. Yes, exactly.
Which may dilute the learning a bit, but well, it's in its own step, I guess. So it's
if you're trying to do too many things at once and test-driven development is unfamiliar, then it may be too much. Then maybe you should do some test-driven development exercises in a familiar language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But whatever you're doing, I think if you just keep in mind, are you setting effective feedback loops for yourself? I think that's essential. Another thing I've noticed, I used to run a Learn to Code meetup in my hometown here, and we'd get a lot of you know, people who were self-taught or boot camp graduates, that sort of thing, which was great. And I saw a lot of, you know, a lot of those people ending up very successfully having programming careers and, you know, being just as good of a contributor to the team as somebody with a university degree, right? But the thing that I noticed that people who didn't go the university route struggled with the most was, I think that the university programs can drill into you doing these exercises and sort of, you're learning a specific technique. You're learning how to write a linked list. You're learning how to do memory management. You're, you know, learning these techniques. And you say, what's going to happen if I do this? What's, you know, what happens if I have a memory leak? And then you see what happens if you do, you see what happens if you don't. There's this scientific method. There's this like empirical approach where you sort of are doing a tailored exercise where you have a hypothesis, you create an experiment to test that hypothesis, and then you evaluate that hypothesis.
And then you learn that you're wrong.
And right. Actually, learning that you're wrong is just as important as learning that you're right. If you only learn that you're right, then you're missing out on all these things you could learn.
Yeah, it's almost better to be wrong. But you need to be right sometimes. Otherwise, you're never learning.
Well, if you're always wrong, I guess you could always just flip it and say,
yeah,
you always know how to be right. It's just not what you initially think.
Should I write a let or a const? I should write a let. Okay, let's do a const. There you go.
There you go. Yeah, so I think that scientific approach is, it's sort of built into the curriculum in a lot of, you know, university programs. Whereas people going through boot camps or self-learning, often it's more just, you know, going through boilerplate for a Rails application or a React application and trying to figure out, trying to find the needle in the haystack that gets things working. And it's not as much like these focused exercises. So sometimes they don't learn those skills of like, what do I expect to happen? How would I know if what I expect to happen happened or not?
Mm-hmm.
And then importantly, doing the final step of evaluating the results, what actually happened. So I think that like calling your shot. So let's take the example of making impossible states impossible. You know, what do I expect to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I expect this particular state to not be possible. How would I know? Well, if I try doing this thing, I try constructing this thing and it doesn't have at least one of these items, then that should be invalid. I should get a mm-hmm. compiler error.
Yep.
And then you try that, right? And it seems very basic, but I think just setting it up that way is so important. So a lot of these, you know, self-taught and bootcamp students, I would sort of give them that advice to slow down when you're learning something. Instead of just trying a bunch of things, slow down for a second and say, what do I expect to happen here? How would I know if what I expect to happen has happened or not? Set up some mechanism to evaluate the success of the experiment and then actually do that afterwards.
I think that's one reason why TDD might be very good for learning, as you said before, because every time you save or you start running your tests, you kind of call the shot, okay, I think this test is going to pass and that it's not going to break one of the other ones. And you get very rapid feedback telling you that, no, you messed it up and things didn't go as you expected. And maybe here's why, or you need to figure that out.
Right.
But then in any case, you're learning something.
I totally agree. And in addition to, you know, giving you feedback to evaluate whether your experiment was successful or not, you know, TDD has this sort of set of ideas for breaking the work into smaller pieces, like doing the simplest thing that could possibly work,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which means you're not doing 100 things at once. You're doing one thing at a time. And so you're better set up to evaluate your experiments.
Sure. I guess when you're learning, you don't know how to cut things as small as you could be. But yeah, definitely.
Yes, right. It is difficult, but also just... yeah, I mean, applying one technique at once is really valuable. And something that I have found myself doing a lot from the time I was learning Elm to now is having a technique I want to experiment with, you know, phantom builder technique. Wow, how would that work? And would that work nicely in application code? Or yes. Just in package code or,
yes.
You know, like, I think it's so good to be curious about those things.
Yeah.
And even if someone smart tells you that something is a good idea, you're a smart guy. But I think that we should come to our own conclusions nonetheless.
I agree. Yeah. There's something I keep telling people, and I've mentioned this on podcast before, when some people argue whether they should or are still undecided whether they should try pattern A or pattern B to do something, Like, hey, should this be a maybe or should this be a new custom type?
Right.
I just tell them, try out one of the ways, the one that you feel most comfortable with. And then if it works out, great. If it doesn't work out, you will know soon enough. If you are keep curious and keep wondering about it, keep reflecting. And then when you finally feel the pain, then you know that it wasn't the right choice.
Yes. And that's a win.
And that's a win. And thankfully, with Elm, at least, it's easy to backtrack. So Elm is a great language to try out things, be curious, and then fail.
Yes.
But then we factor and get it right.
Yes.
Writer. Because you might not find the right solution right away either.
That's a good t-shirt. Be curious and then fail. Then refactor and get it right or writer. Boom. T-shirt.
Yeah. Do you want me to get it longer or?
Yeah, it may be a tall vertical.
Or write it also in the back. but I mean, being curious is part of the scientific method, right?
Yes.
If you're not wondering about the effects of something or the causes of something, then you're not really going to figure out new things or learn a lot.
Yes. And you can't bypass failure. So, you know, you should celebrate the failure because it means you're learning. Like if you know, really, if you're like, why can't everything just be maybe in my model? Why not? Well, great. Like, don't let somebody tell you that having too many maybes in your model is a code smell. If you're like, why couldn't I just have everything be a maybe? What's wrong with that? And then I'll just do maybe with default a bunch of places. Try it. Try it. Maybe try it in a side project. Maybe try it in a place where it's low stakes to fail. You know,
yeah.
Don't go change the production code base to have everything suddenly have a maybe everywhere and make your coworkers unhappy. But try it in a safe place.
Yeah. And reflect on it at some point.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. That's the other thing is like people forget the last step of the scientific method. They forget to evaluate the results. So don't skip that step. That is a very important step. I think, you know, another thing, are you familiar with this term growth mindset?
A tiny bit, but let's imagine I don't.
I'm very fond of this concept. It's something by Carol Dweck, psychology researcher. She's written a lot on this. And so the idea is that growth mindset is, it's the attitude that you have something to learn from being challenged and putting yourself in a position where you might fail. That's a positive thing, that you can battle test your skills. And that might involve failure, and that's a good thing because it means you're growing. Fixed mindset is the idea that, wait a minute, I don't want to put my failure out there because then people will see that I'm a failure. And it's basically the idea that, you know, putting myself out there and failing means that I'm incompetent, not that I'm growing. So it's the idea that your abilities are sort of fixed. I'm good at math or I'm bad at math rather than... So basically like saying I'm good at math, the idea would be don't do that and don't encourage other people to do that. And don't use language that implies that. So instead of saying like, wow, look how smart you are. You got an A on the math test. You say like, wow, look how your hard work paid off on this test. You focus on the reward of challenging yourself because it's the idea that your abilities and intelligence are not fixed things. They're things that can grow over time by going through challenges and learning. So I think that's really essential to all these things we're talking about because, again, like if you're viewing putting too many maybes in your model as a sign that, oh, maybe I'm just not good at Elm, maybe I'm just not good at data modeling. Well, then you're limiting yourself because you're not allowing yourself to experiment and fail. Like, and if you think that quote unquote smart people are smart because they never went through those failures, it's just not the reality. Like people who seem smart are smart because they try those things and fail. They say, why can't I put maybes everywhere? And then they try it. That's what makes them smart is they went through those failures. So don't limit yourself.
Maybe they also got a good teacher, but you can find one as well.
Yes, that's also true. Yeah. And, you know, another thing that's been coming up in all the stuff we've been talking about here is I think things need to be hands-on. You can hear a conference talk, you can hear a podcast episode, you can hear some interesting idea. But like if you hear Jeroen give some brilliant summary of the Phantom Builder and you follow everything he's saying, that doesn't mean you've actually learned the Phantom Builder technique.
Because I'm a bad teacher. Mm-hmm.
Right, exactly. Because Jeroen's a bad teacher.
This should also be a t-shirt.
Jeroen's a bad teacher t-shirt. Yeah. We're going to have to make a lot of t-shirts here.
Yeah.
So these, you need to take learning into your own hands, no matter how brilliant an explanation is. The way that our brain consumes information, it's just that. It's not about consuming information. It's about engaging with information and making it your own. Knowledge isn't something that you get from someone. It's something that you build up yourself with someone's help. So someone can guide you through, but you always have to make learning your own. You have to internalize it. You have to connect it to what you know, to your mental models, your way of understanding things. And there's no way to directly transfer knowledge. And so if you think that you can just read a book or watch a conference talk and just Matrix style, I know Kung Fu it, it's unfortunately not how it works. You don't just install this knowledge in your brain. You have to engage with it. You have to like test it out and be skeptical of it and say, like, you know, is this a technique? Is the Phantom Builder technique, like, doesn't it have these problems? Like, if you don't ask yourself, wouldn't it have problems in these situations? Even if it doesn't, if you don't ask that question, do you really understand it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some topics where you don't have to interact with it directly to grasp it, but you're not going to learn it unless you apply it actively. But I imagine that there are some topics where you just knowing about it and keeping it in the back of your mind will help you cross-pollinate it with other topics and then give you a brilliant idea at some point. But I imagine it's much easier if you make it an active practice.
Right. Yeah, there's certainly value to just knowing that something exists as an idea, even if you don't apply it. So knowing that phantom types is a thing and having some sense that, oh, it can help you, you know, enforce certain things about types without actually changing the underlying data that it contains. If you have that concept somewhere in the back of your head, maybe you don't know exactly what it means or how it applies. Mm-hmm. Maybe when you run into a problem around that, then you can apply it.
Yeah.
So there's value to that.
And then you just delay the practice in a way.
Yes. Yes. Right. And I think to a certain extent, that's one of the roles of things like conferences. Many conference talks, you know, they're not tutorials. They're not going to help you master a topic, but they let you know that it exists so you can explore it further on your own.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that you view them as motivational, inspirational, which I think is a pretty good way to view them.
Yeah, and there's value to that. And if you watch a conference, like, I think it's worth stating, just because you need to apply things to learn them, test them for yourself, experiment, all these things, it doesn't mean you need to do that for everything.
No.
And in fact, I think you should do them for things that seem important at the time because, you know, Richard was talking a lot about motivation for teaching Elm. Well, he was talking about motivation because he was saying for somebody to learn something, it's important to have motivation that thing is meaningful. So this is essential. Like, don't just learn. I think don't learn things just because. Learn things because they're interesting and meaningful to you. And focus your efforts on that. And if something can always become interesting and meaningful in the future, don't feel like you just, oh, I have to learn SQL. I have to learn database stuff. I have to learn fauna. I have to learn this CSS technique. If it seems important and interesting, then learn about it. If it doesn't, then there's always going to be some relevant problem, some relevant technique at the time. Focus on that.
Mm. So if you find a practical use of a technique or a concept, then learn it. Otherwise, just go with your curiosity, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot about like just in time versus just in case learning. And actually, this is a problem that I personally have with a lot of university programs and school curriculums, is that they often are learning you, they're learning you, they're often teaching you a mm-hmm. lot of things just in case you need them.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And another problem often with school curriculums is that they don't focus enough on project-based learning. So they're not giving you opportunities to apply the techniques. So you're just doing sort of exercises out of context. You know, if a train is traveling this speed and another train is traveling this speed, how long will it take for them to hit each other? And you know, it's like, all right, well, but you should apply that to a meaningful problem when you need it. And so...
But what if I'm working at a railway company?
Well, then that's important knowledge. Then you should then you should learn that really fast.
Then yeah. I wish that my school curriculum taught me that.
I think you would. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I would hope that would be a requirement beforehand. So yeah. No, but I think pressuring ourselves to learn things just because I should know that, you know, once you're working as a developer, I think you can, there's plenty of stuff to learn constantly. So you may as well prioritize the things that are immediately relevant and applicable. And those are things that naturally have motivation. So you're going to learn them better because you have a reason to care about them. So they're going to stick better. And you have a place to apply them and experiment with them. So you're going to be able to actually fully synthesize that knowledge.
So what about things that feel hard? For instance, mm-hmm. I have a lot of problems with learning CSS.
Yes.
What would you recommend me as to how to learn it? Because on a case-by-case basis, I can learn, oh, here I need flex, here I need CSS grid, and here I need absolute position. And I can learn that in isolation. I'm going to forget it. I'm going to learn it again. But at some point, it's going to stick. But I still need to learn plenty of things around it that I don't need right now and that I don't feel motivated to learn about.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
don't tell me just learn Elm UI.
Yeah. CSS is such a challenging one because you really do, like, it's hard to pick one topic to learn because things are so interconnected.
You know,
but I mean, I do notice this sometimes when you know, when I'm learning something and I'm thinking, I'm kind of banging my head against a wall here. Like, I need to get a little more systematic about how I'm learning something. And to be honest, you know, things like Flexbox and grid layout and absolute and things like that in CSS are something that I could benefit from learning a little more systematically. So sometimes I think we need to step back from the everyday just trying to figure things out. I mean, this gets back to this empiricism calling the shot sort of thing. If we're sitting there going through these Flexbox options and just randomly changing things and then we finally get it working, we're like, okay, good. Then take a moment and read a thoughtful Flexbox tutorial that, you know, explains things with a clear mental model. Try to learn a little bit. Try to call your shot and say, okay, what set of magical attributes are gonna give me the expected behavior? Did that actually happen? If it didn't, evaluate, why not? And then you can learn instead of constantly making the same mistakes over and over.
Yeah. I don't know if you've encountered the games for CSS Flex
yes.
and CSS Grid,
no, like those
with
are
the,
awesome.
The carrots mm-hmm. and the frogs. And
frogs. I love the frog yeah. one. Yeah. Yes.
Those were good because you get feedback really quickly.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I totally agree.
I'm pretty sure that the amount of knowledge I have about those techniques come from that and
yes.
one or two blog posts that are very good detailed summaries of those techniques.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so one of my favorite learning techniques, I don't know, this is just like a concept, very clear concept in my head that I gravitate towards often, which is demystifying things. So if I notice that something is fuzzy in my head a little bit, for example, I notice this often with, you know, in Elm, people are a little bit fuzzy about custom type constructors and type alias record constructors. You know, so it's like, oh, people will mix up. There's like the type space and the expression space.
Yeah, value space, I call it.
Value space, that's a good word for it. Yeah. Yeah, value space and type space. Type space can live in type signatures and type aliases. And value space can live in the body of functions. And people will mix up, you know, when you say type user equals user, they'll mix up the thing on the left and the thing on the right. The thing on the left is in type space. The thing on the right is in value space. And so in cases like that, I think it's really important to demystify things. That's the term I think of when I'm going through that process myself. I notice something being a little fuzzy. It feels a little bit magical. And break down that magic so it's not magic. Because if it feels magical, then what ends up happening is you end up flailing around trying things rather than being able to just sort of, you know, build up a clear model. It prevents you from building up a clear mental model because you're constantly trying things in a way where you're sort of guessing. And there's one little piece. And if you demystified that tiny little thing, you know, in the case of like these custom types where there's a thing on the left and a thing on the right, the variance on the right, the type on the left, it really takes 5 minutes to demystify that if you do it systematically. And what does demystifying look like? Like I've got an exercise I sometimes have people do where, you know, you just sort of, you know, play around with that and see what happens and do these experiments with things on the left of custom type declarations and things on the right, the variance. And just break it down and poke holes in it and see how it works. And you take 5 minutes, you demystify it. And then every time you deal with that issue, it's no longer guesswork and, you know, trying to get it to work. You can just demystify it once and then you've got it.
Because after demystifying, you have probably a good grasp of what it means. You've learned it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, learn it once and for all with these tiny little things. They're these small things that trip us up. And so I think it's worth noticing when you have that little fuzziness on a small little thing, it can go a long way. Because if a tiny part of it feels confusing and magical, then everything feels confusing and magical. So hone in on that one thing that's confusing.
So you have now demystified value space and type space. You've learned it, you understand it, but at some point you forget it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
what
mm-hmm.
do you do against mm-hmm. that? Or yes. how do you relearn it?
Quickly? Ah, good question. Well, I've got a lot of secret notes here that I've hidden from Jeroen. So he read my mind and jumped to one of my bullet points.
Yes.
Very nice.
Or did you anticipate my question?
Yes.
Then you are much better than I am.
No. I think you read my mind a little there. So I think note-taking is something I'm trying to be more deliberate about recently. I've really invested in my note-taking strategy. Do you have a note-taking system, Jeroen?
I do. I have an app or two or three. Mm-hmm, sometimes I switch. Mm-hmm. Yeah, where I write most things that come to mind. Well, I say most things, but not too many things.
You have notes on performance, Elm performance, things like that?
Yeah, I don't have anything deliberate. Sometimes I watch conference talks, for instance, and I try to write down stuff that is written on the slides that I think could be interesting to keep in mind. For instance, for benchmarks, performance, I usually write that in Elm, in the code, so that everything is in the same place. So I guess code is in a way a note-taking app.
It can be, yeah. I mean, if you apply a particular technique to something, or if you have a little repo that you use to experiment with something, you can always go back there. That's a good point. Yeah, I really like this technique of mind mapping as well, where you have, you know, you start in the center with the core topic of the notes. Mm-hmm. You know, make impossible states impossible, and then it branches out to things, and you say, you know, custom types, and then custom types branches out to phantom types, and et cetera, et cetera. They all kind of have these. The idea is that it allows you to have like free flowing ideas that are just short one or two word summaries rather than long form notes. So it's like quick to take the notes, it's quick to at a glance see what you've written. I think that's a very effective learning technique and for recall as well.
Yeah, and I guess that silos the concepts as well. So you can learn about custom types in isolation and then learn about type aliases in isolation, learn about phantom types in isolation. And when you've learned all of those, you know Kung Fu, making impossible states impossible.
Exactly. Oh, it's a fine line between Kung Fu and making impossible states impossible.
We should just rename making impossible states impossible. It's too long to say as well.
How about Umfu?
Umfu, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. You know that your system is working when you know where to look to find something you can't immediately remember.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something to be said for that. There's a very controversial post going around the day that we're recording this. I don't know if you've seen it by DHH 37 Signals.
Maybe no. I haven't seen it.
He's basically saying don't be copy pasta pirates who are incompetent and celebrating your incompetence by not being able to do anything yourself and having to just search for everything and copy paste it. And come on, don't be a jerk.
Don't tell people what to do and how to be.
Yeah. And especially when you're just so wrong about it. Come on. Copy pasting is okay. Like, it happens all the time, but hopefully your learning and your mental models can make it easier over time to find the information you need. You don't need to store it in your brain. You just need to be able to know where to find it and understand the bigger picture of when it would be useful. So, you know, if you forget how to do phantom types, that's okay. But if you know when to look for it and have some sense of when it applies, that's what you need. If you sort of forget how you do opaque types, which that's a tricky thing when you're first kind of learning that concept. You don't have to feel bad for like looking something up or copy pasting something to start with an opaque type. You know, you can just start
the episode 2 of Elm Radio again,
which you really should. Yes, because opaque types are so useful. But however you arrive at that, if your brain knows to go to look for it in that place, that's great. So just being able to navigate things, however you do that, even if it's like searching for the same Stack Overflow post every time that you need to like remember whether you should do like a script tag with a defer in it or not with defer, or if you should put it in the body, at the bottom of the body, in the head, where you should put it. You don't need to memorize that. You just need to be able to find that information when you need it and know that you have that information that you should find because there's something important you need to do. That's all you need.
Please send me the notes for that one because I don't remember that.
Oh my gosh. Neither do I. But if you have something that like, as long as you know you need to get it, and if you have a system of notes that helps you find that, that's great. But notes are not cheating, you know? Notes are not cheating. Copy-pasting is not cheating. If there's like a useful go-to blog post, I actually find that often there'll just be a really good blog post and that becomes my reference for something. And like, I'll go through my like browser search history and find that blog post over and over, and that's fine. That works, you know?
Yeah. But just taking notes is not enough. You need to practice afterwards.
Right. Yeah. Practicing. So increasingly something that I've been developing a lot recently is a system around this sort of second brain idea, Zettelkasten second brain. And the idea, like there's a really great book. I think it's called How to Take Smart Notes. Kind of a strange title. It doesn't fully do it justice, but it's about this second brain concept. It's about the guy who kind of created this Zettelkasten system. So it's a very interesting read. And one of the things it talks about is interconnecting notes and concepts and the importance of this richness of referencing things. You know, this sort of Rome research has sort of popularized this idea of like back references in notes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
So in my own incremental Elm site, I've created a back referencing system.
Yeah, so kind of like you have a wiki page.
Yeah.
You write notes in your wiki page.
Right.
And then you have sources and citations at the bottom.
Yes, yes. And you interconnect the information richly within itself, and you can create sort of index pages where, you know, you say, here's everything I know about data modeling in Elm, and you link that to make impossible states impossible, phantom types, opaque types, your runes hierarchy of constraints, which we've talked about many times. And so now one difference with like wikis in this sort of second brain philosophy is that similar to wikis, you're trying to create sort of atomic notes that can cross-reference each other. But unlike a wiki, you try more to make declarative statements about things, sort of propositions about your beliefs about things.
Okay. So
like, for example, I've got a note on my Incremental Elm site called Use the Platform. And it's about this idea of, if you create a form that's not actually a form tag in HTML, then what happens? Well, you submit it with JavaScript, but what happens if you click enter? Well, maybe nothing, right? But a form is supposed to have certain behavior when you hit enter. So you've missed that enter key handling, and now you need to manually go create that with on enter handlers. But also, more importantly, you need to remember what those things are. You need to be aware of what happens in a screen reader if it's handling a form element. And then you need to make those things happen manually. So use the platform, because if you just make a form tag in Elm and then you add an on submit handler, and you use a proper submit button that's a real submit button in the form, even if you intercept the on submit action and do something in Elm, that's okay. But at least you're using the platform as much as possible. So, but that's this sort of stake in the ground that I'm putting a flag down and saying, here's a claim I'm making. Now that claim might evolve. Maybe somebody, as happens on the internet, you put out an idea and people are going to push back on that claim. But that's great. That strengthens it. Now, I'm not trying to make bombastic, rude, aggressive claims, but I'm trying to make sort of verifiable claims that somebody could in earnest push back on. But so that's a difference with a wiki. It's not just like the platform, the entry on the platform or on form tags. It's a sort of statement of a belief or an idea. Use the platform. And so it sharpens your ideas on things and it gives you a place to look. And in the process of writing those posts, I try to do more rigorous than casual research into examples of that, finding examples of places where using the platform saves you from having to do, several things manually that come for free when you use the platform. And I try to support it with ideas like, what if a future platform comes along and uses these declarative things, assuming you're using the platform? And what if future features come from using the platform, you have to anticipate those and handle them in the future. So I can sort of like really develop this idea, and it gives me a place mm-hmm. to develop it over time, support my idea. If somebody says, what are your thoughts on this concept? I can link them to something. And anyway, I've been really enjoying that as a technique for learning and developing ideas.
So basically you're trying to write opinions, not instead of information, but information plus your opinion on it.
Yeah. I would say maybe like claims just to sort of harden a stance. I guess what's the phrase? Like a firm beliefs loosely held or something like that. If you just have sort of fuzzy ideas about things, then you're not going to really crystallize your thinking.
Yeah, so if you write claims or opinions or mm-hmm. form them in your mind in the mm-hmm. first place, then you're more likely to remember them. Is that kind of the idea?
Yes, you're more likely mm-hmm. to remember them, and you might learn by somebody pushing back. So I think it's again very important to do it in a respectful way, in a way where you're not being antagonistic to anybody, but just making a claim and see it as your current thinking and be open to changing that belief if better information comes along.
So that also means that you need to put it to make it public in a way.
Yeah, that's increasingly a part of this second brain philosophy, at least this digital gardening philosophy. That's been part of it for me, at least. I don't think it's necessarily a requirement for second brain, but I've been really enjoying, people talk about this sort of learn in public movement and digital gardening, and I've I've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed having a public place to share thoughts and back them. Like sometimes people will ask a question or they'll, you know, say like, why is SEO important? And I can sort of formulate my thoughts and then share a link. And I love that.
So do you have a comment section on your notes?
I've been thinking about adding one. There are some systems for doing that with like GitHub issues where you can have like a okay. repo for your blog that is just for the issues. And then people can just post a reply on the GitHub issue and it shows up as a comment. I may do that. I think that would be fun. Yeah. Yeah. If you wanted to, you could reply about Jeroen's hierarchy of constraints and set the record straight if you need to, if I misrepresent it.
I mean, you coined the term.
I did. But see, that's to my point, coining the term, now it's like a meaningful concept. That
is true.
It was a recurring thing.
It wasn't even a concept in my mind all that much.
Right. But it was something that you brought up often.
Yeah.
And so by noticing that, giving it a place to live as a phrase and as a URL, I think that's really powerful.
That is true. Or that just made me more opinionated on it being true when it might not be true.
But you know what? I think that we have like opinions and beliefs naturally. And if we don't give them some concrete formulation, we don't give them the opportunity to evolve and change. So I don't think it makes us any less opinionated to not like state our ideas and beliefs and claims. I think it just allows us to be more cowardly about them and not really put them to the test.
All right. I have a claim.
Yes.
I would claim that Elm is easier to learn than other languages because it is simpler. It has fewer features and fewer keywords and just less things to learn. Meaning that when you write Elm code, you encounter and therefore practice the same concepts more than in other languages.
I like this idea. Yes.
Yes.
Sounds like a blog post.
It is a claim. It is true.
It is true. Proven. Stamp of approval. I do like that. I do like this idea that reusing a set of constructs and techniques is very powerful. Very powerful stuff. Good sign of an API in general, whether it's a language or a library.
I mean, do you know how the with statement works in JavaScript?
I don't even know what a with statement is.
I'm just checking whether it's not a thing only in Python. No, there's a with statement in JavaScript. Yeah, you never encounter it because JavaScript is too big. And people say it's a bad thing anyway.
Whoa. So the with expression, the with statement in JavaScript, fascinating.
Yeah, don't use it. I don't remember what it does, but I know it's bad.
Wow, that's so interesting. Yeah, and speaking of, you know, with regard to learning, I think another useful idea in learning that I try to keep in mind is technical communication. I think it's worth, now again, don't be a jerk, don't judge people and be rude about this, but I think we can always strive to be more precise with our technical communication.
So you mean don't communicate on Twitter with 140 characters or 280?
Well, perhaps don't venture out there. But I think there can be good discussions there. But for example, one thing that I find myself reaching for that I always have to try to be precise about is statement versus expression. So, you know, an expression being something which has a value and a statement does not have a value. So like I think in Elm, you know, statements include import statements, port declaration statements. Those are things that don't have values. You can't like use them somewhere, but it's not a case statement. And sometimes I have to correct myself. I start to say case statement because I'm used to switch statements in JavaScript and other languages, which they are statements in JavaScript and Java. They're not expressions. They don't have values. It's an if statement doesn't have a value. You can't say var username equals if. But in Elm, you can. Well, you can't say var because it's not var. But you get the idea. It's an expression that you can use. And anyway, just being precise about that, I think, has value. I think it keeps you know, it helps you sharpen your mental models about things, keep things demystified, keep things from being sort of blurry, fuzzy things. So I think, you know, try to hold yourself to a high standard of being precise with how you think about things and communicate things.
Yeah, but it goes a bit counter to what we discussed with Richard about not being precise all the time.
Mm.
Dilute the details. Don't mention all the details at once. Teach them as they need to learn them.
Right. Well, I guess there's the distinction between accurate and precise, where, you know, accurate means that you're not straying from the truth. You're being correct and accurate. And precise, it's the precision. So how fine-grained is your accuracy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How specific are you being? So I think we should always strive to be accurate.
Yeah. Or tell people, this is not entirely accurate. I'm simplifying things.
Yeah. But ideally, we can avoid that, right? Ideally, we can find a way to present information that is, you know, where it naturally unfolds in a way that we don't have to give all the details at once, but we don't have to give any incorrect information. But yeah, I mean, I think in subtle ways we can, like, I don't know, saying that something is an expression. I think that's a good thing to be aware of. At least I try to be, you know, aware of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So we talked about applying techniques, actively doing exercises. But when you are learning something, do you write small exercises to yourself? Like trick questions for later you, for later Dylan. Like, hey, what can I do with the custom type? Are you able to do X with custom types? Yes or no? Later Dylan, please reply, please answer the question.
I would tend to do more like code exercises or solving small problems than like writing questions. But yeah, I mean, I'll try to write some notes on things like that, but often, for me, you know, we're a little unique in this regard. I think you're in probably that our side projects have taken on lives of their own, that they've become more than side projects for us a little bit. Mm-hmm. And not everybody needs to be that way with how seriously they take their side projects and how much they invest in their side projects. We're a bit extreme, but I do think that there's value to side projects, you know, however modest or simple a side project may be. I think that that's a really great place to experiment with ideas. And I know for me that it's been absolutely essential that whenever I have a new concept, you know, I remember my early days of Elm, like watching Richard's Elm Europe keynote one year where he was talking about extensible records and, you know, passing through as little information as possible to try to narrow types down and narrow where you need to follow data to understand what it depends on and what it can affect by what it returns, if it returns a command or not, if it returns the whole model or just part of the model, things like that, right? He gave a great talk about that. And it really was like a lot of new information. When I first saw that, it was like, wow, I have a lot to process that is very much not part of the way I think about Elm. And I need to really sit with this. In fact, I remember like watching that talk more than once when I first saw it, when it first came out, because there was so much information for me to process there, so much new stuff. But I went through the mobster code base and I applied that as many places as I could. And probably too much in some cases. Like I probably used extensible records a little bit too much because he sort of introduced this idea of narrowing what something depends on and what something can affect, like what fields it can change in a record using extensible records. And perhaps I went a little too far on that. But you know what? Like you can't bypass the failure. To learn, you need to try things. And so for me, side projects have been really important for that. Just creating like just going a little bit crazy with a side project. Like I remember Richard talked in one of his talks about using, what's it called? DreamWriter?
Mm-hmm.
His DreamWriter app?
Yeah, I think that was the name.
And he was saying that he kind of like, he's like, well, why couldn't you have like these mini Elm architectures nested like components? And he like experimented and basically started hating working on the app after like he really got it to a point that he loved working on it and making changes there. And then he started to hate it because he did this like big refactoring to componentization. and he talked about like having all these bugs at one point in DreamWriter with like state being mismatched. And then he, you know, started, I think he started trying to like derive state rather than duplicating it and passing it around. And so, you know, I mean, I think this is really how people explore, figure out new techniques, learn new techniques, is you try it, you experiment, and having a safe space, like a side project to experiment, is very valuable in my experience.
Mm. Also having a safe state of your side project.
Yes.
Like a good Git history.
Absolutely.
Helps. So Richard could have backtracked out of all this refactoring.
Right.
He would be happy, and he would be working on DreamWriter right now.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes our side projects pay the price when we get a little too eager. So another thing I find myself doing a lot is, we talked about being curious, and I think being curious is huge. When you're curious, go look at the source code, even if you don't understand it, even if it makes no sense to you. Just if you ever find yourself wondering, it's just a little habit that you don't have to fully understand it. But just be a little bit curious and be like, is that even possible? How does it even do that? Like, how does, you know, like if you see something that looks a little funny, like I remember figuring out this technique about what I like to call package opaque types, where it's like a type that you can create anywhere within the code for an Elm package, but you can't create that type. That type constructor is not exposed outside of the package. I remember seeing something like in Elm UI, like that it's like type alias element equals element. I'm like,
yeah,
what the heck is that? You just look at something that looks a little bit weird and follow your curiosity. And you know, you don't have to, you're not on the hook to perfectly understand everything about it, but just a little bit, get curious and say, that seems weird. I wonder what it is. Click view source in the package. And go to that element module and see type alias element equals, where is that defined? Oh, it's follow the import. Oh, it goes to this thing. Oh, it's in this internals dot something module.
Yeah. And it's just a custom type.
It's just a custom type, but it's defined in an internals module. Is there something special about internals? Oh, I see. No, the only thing that's special about it is that it's not an exposed module in the elm.json for a package. You can have exposed modules, and the internals package by convention are not exposed. That's all it is. But you can learn new techniques that way. You can learn a lot just by clicking view source.
I mean, it's so nice that all packages in the Elm community are open source, and you can look at the source code. That lowers the barrier to learning. And you learn so much from doing that. I've been recently digging into the compiled code. So learning how compiled code works, the compiled JavaScript from Elm code, I mean. And some things became demystified. Yeah, even things like, I think that pattern matching works this way. And if you think you know something, but you're not really sure, then you start assuming things and making hypotheses about things, and they may be wrong. For instance, I was thinking, if I do pattern matching this way on lists, then, or on something else, then the compiled code will be more performant because I ordered this before that, for instance. And that turned out not to be true when I looked at the compiled code sometimes. The compiler was smart enough to do things in a more performant way, or it didn't do it the way I expected. So yeah, looking at the compiled source code or looking at package library code removes those blurry, those fuzzy images that you have in your mind. And when you look at them, you know, you learn, and everything becomes clear.
Yeah. 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 I think, you know, you want to think at a high level of abstraction, but it can be really valuable to understand what's, you know, under the hood a little bit, to just get comfortable peeking under the hood a tiny bit.
Yeah. I don't recommend looking at the 10,000, 20,000 lines of code of Elm compiled code. I should have better spend my time.
But if you take something away for that mental model, you know, it's super valuable. You know, this second brain stuff has this, controversial claim, if you will.
Okay, which they wrote in a note.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. Basically, the author of this How to Take Smart Notes book said that he basically wrote the book by just taking his notes and sort of organizing them differently and rewording some things. But he basically just took his notes that he already had, and his book was just boom, you know. Which the guy who originally created the Zettelkasten system was known for being like a prolific writer. That he was like a sociologist, I believe, and wrote hundreds of books. Even after he passed away, he posthumously published dozens of books, I think, because people just went through his notes and there were all these ideas that they were just able to extract and create books out of. It's very interesting.
Huh. So prolific that people are publishing your things afterwards.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? Yeah, it's fascinating. And so this sort of second brain philosophy has this, I think, sort of bold claim that if you're not writing, you're not learning. And I'm not sure if I agree with that yet, but it's definitely challenging me in a good way. I think it's good to be challenged a little bit, to have your beliefs challenged.
So if the listener to this episode has not written everything down.
Exactly.
They haven't learned anything.
So that's right.
Please press replay and start writing things down.
That's right. That's right. I mean, we've got to build up our mental models, and writing can certainly help with that. To me, that's one technique, but I think it's a powerful sentiment, and I think there's definitely value to that concept. And by the way, I should reference that a lot of the ideas on learning, this book, Make It Stick, has been a really big influence on me. I really enjoyed this book. It's written by like a couple of neuroscientists, just sort of evaluating the literature on what we know about how the brain learns. And so a lot of these concepts come from there. I'll leave like a little link to some notes from that book from the internet. But yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in that book. So maybe like a kind of wrapping up a little bit here, but maybe on a final note, like another thing which we talked about, I think, in our API design lessons episode, you know, we don't do all our learning in our conscious brain, prefrontal cortex, inner monologue. A lot of learning happens when we sleep, in our background processing of our brain. Our brain is doing all these things in the background without us knowing about it, but
yeah, especially right before sleeping, in my case.
yeah, and that's good. And we should optimize for the way our brain works, which is it does a whole bunch of stuff in the background, and we don't have to do everything, but we can tee things up for it. And so these things like writing notes can help it sort of have some things to chew on and process in the background. We can sort of pose questions and let our background processing work on that in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing, there's a really nice book by Dan Pink called When, and I had a really nice takeaway from that book that really stuck with me, which is this idea that we have different modalities of thinking that our brain is most natural at in different times of day. So if you're an early bird like myself, then in the mornings you're going to be more alert and analytical, and in the evenings you're going to be better able to make connections and think of innovative ideas. So
that sounds right. That sounds about right.
And if you're a night owl, it's the opposite.
Oh, no. That doesn't sound right to me.
Interesting. Interesting.
Well, maybe I should analyze that. Hmm. But I should do that in the morning. No, in the evening. Oh. It's complicated.
It's interesting. So he says that the way you tell if you're an early bird or a night owl is basically, naturally, if there's no work schedule or anything like that to wake you up? Do you tend to wake up, you know, whatever, like before 8:30 or after 8:30 or something like that? Anyway, but the point is, like, pay attention to how your brain naturally works and feed it problems that it's suited to solve. So for myself, if I'm thinking about some problem that requires a lot of creative thinking, mm-hmm. I'm not going to do a great job of that in the morning, but I am going to be really good at doing research, gathering prior art, thinking about a lot of ideas that will let my more creative thinking mm-hmm. kick in later in the evening. So, you know, I try to optimize for that a little bit.
Right. Yeah. So I was wondering, because we did an episode about teaching, and now we talked about learning, and you mentioned writing notes quite extensively. Do you think that writing notes is a way of teaching yourself or someone else? So do you get the same benefits when you teach someone or multiple people as when you write notes in a good way? You know,
I think so. Very much so. Very much so. Actually, one of the things in this book, Make It Stick, is it actually talks about how there's something different in your brain that kicks in when you're learning something in order to teach it, or when mm-hmm. you're just learning it. So,
oh, okay.
And this, I mean, partially this goes to the motivation question. Like if you're learning something with a purpose, then your brain finds places to fill in that information. Because the brain learning is not about transferring knowledge from one box to another box or copying it. Learning is about making connections, making associations. Our brains are association machines. And the more things you can connect an idea to in your own mental model that's meaningful to you, the more you understand that thing, the better you've learned it. And so
I guess when you try to teach someone, you will do so with your own words, obviously.
Yes.
And when the teaching doesn't come across, then you try to find a new way to explain things. So you need to find new connections, new metaphors, and that builds a new mental model, I guess.
Absolutely.
So, yes. Same benefits.
Exactly. Yeah. And it is, you know, the Make It Stick talks quite a bit about this difference between following something and understanding something. So we can, I mean, like, I think a good analogy is if you're driving in the passenger seat and you're like, okay, we're going, you know, we're turning right at this light and we're, you know, going straight down this road and we go past these buildings. You can follow the path, but would you be able to be put in the car at the starting point and drive that route yourself? Probably not. Whereas, if somebody's in the driver's seat and they're following GPS instructions and you say, okay, go drive the road again after without a GPS, they'd be much more likely to be able to do it because they're actually making those choices where you might not pay attention to the fact that they're making a particular turn because you're just following what they're doing. You're not actually evaluating, well, I could have turned left here, I could have gone straight, I could have gone right. It's the same with learning. If you're just like, oh, okay, I'm with you so far, we have the illusion that we're comprehending what they're saying, but we're actually just following it. But we haven't carved out those deep questions. So then if you go to explain that to somebody else, if you explain Phantom or the Phantom Builder pattern, and then someone says, hey, what is the Phantom Builder pattern again? And I go to explain it, then I might start explaining it and find myself getting lost and saying, oh, wait a minute, but would you use it in this case or would it be a bad fit for that? And would you be able to model this type of thing or not? And getting stuck somewhere because even if I followed everything you said, I hadn't taught it. I hadn't made that learning my own. So yeah, teaching is a very powerful way to make learning your own.
Yeah. But if Jeroen was a better teacher, then you wouldn't know how to explain that.
Well, you know, perhaps if you had the opportunity to do some exercises in a workshop, mm-hmm. it's limited what you can do just by talking and somebody hearing you talk. It's just, that's not how you get smarter. That's part of it. That can be an important ingredient, but it's not enough on its own. So is there anything on your radar that you are looking to learn next in the Elm world you're in?
I tend to try and discover things, like ways of improving things or forbidding things in my case, usually.
Yeah.
And yeah, I guess I'm learning through that.
Mm-hmm.
Having a side project does take a lot of time, and it's not always teaching you a lot, I think. But
right,
when you reach new edges, when I need to work with something that I don't know much, then I learn. But when I'm doing pretty much what I'm already am used to, then I'm not progressing.
Right. Sometimes there's just grunt work that you need to do where you're not necessarily learning a new technique. And sometimes you have to be deliberate about applying a new technique and learning it. But I've noticed that, I mean, like your blog posts on your jfmengels.net blog, you're exploring a lot of ideas there, you know, I mean, and you've shared your learnings on this podcast about, performance, tail recursion. Now you're looking at like compiler output stuff, looking at code complexity and how to evaluate that in different ways. And I'm sure those things have an impact on how you write code, not just benefiting from having written those Elm review rules, but it changes how you think about complexity in code or performance, things like that. So
I don't even need my Elm review rules anymore. It's all in my mind.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, but I want a tool to take care of that. That's why I wrote them.
That's the irony. And you know, the more you love Elm, the more you write JavaScript to help you write Elm, right? That's the other the curse of loving Elm too much. Yeah.
Or Haskell.
Yep.
Yeah, the people who write the tools for Elm usually don't write Elm. In my case, I made the lucky bet of writing it in Elm.
That is great.
I think your case as well, mostly.
There's both. Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, I guess we've sort of pointed out some books. We can kind of link to some articles about some of the things we've talked about. Growth mindset, make it stick.
Second brain.
Really fascinating stuff. If you find any statements in my incremental Elm notes that you'd like to push back on and be a part of the learning experience for me and be a part of the discussion, I always welcome discussions on those. Love to hear people's thoughts. And if you enjoy Elm Radio, don't forget to share it with a friend and rate us on Apple Podcasts. That helps us a lot. And Yarun, until next time.
Until next time.